Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. This week, my special guest is Dr. Robert Moore, a microbiologist trained at the Australian National University and the University of Sydney. He now works as a freelance biotechnology consultant specialising in algae. Living in Adelaide, South Australia, which is currently a hub of research on algae as biofuels, Dr. Moore continues to campaign to interested parties nationally and internationally and is well known and respected in the field. He's completed several postdoctoral positions researching algae from many viewpoints. Dr. Bob Moore, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Hi, Helen. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thank you. Now, tell us a little bit about your background, Bob, and how you found this new, it's not a species, it's a phylum of algae.
Yes. It's funny you should ask me because they asked me that in a job interview just yesterday.
Oh.
And I said the same thing. I was saying, how long do I have? So they wanted, they were scientists listening.
Yes.
I happen to have, similar to you, Helen, a qualification in science journalism.
Yes.
So I think I could convert it down to about 1 minute.
Yeah.
My PhD was in corals.
Yes.
So the new algae that I discovered live inside corals.
Isn't algae in coral that create the colour and they live in a symbiotic relationship with the coral, yeah.
So next time you happen to be out scuba diving, snorkeling, look for this colour. Of course, in SpongeBob and these shows, you'll see that all the corals are beautifully coloured. Blues and greens and pinks, but when you're actually out snorkeling and looking at these things, even in some temperate waters, you can see anemones with this character. All of the corals on the Great Barrier Reef, for instance, would just be a murky brown colour. It's a pretty kind of orangey brown colour. And what that is the symbiotic algae that live inside.
Yeah.
And you're quite right, I was working with those, and I was hoping to be able to culture those out from inside the coral, which can be difficult. There's more than one algal strain or individual living in there. They're dividing asexually and they're occupying that coral totally. And I was after a particular individual strain out of the corals.
Mm.
But I found that quite accidentally these other ones grew. And rather than ignoring them, I asked people, what are they? So I asked the world's top experts. And nobody had a good answer, so I decided I would undertake a description of them.
And?
Well, what we discovered was these are a missing link, if you were, in between the organisms that are responsible for malaria, of all things.
Plasmodium.
That's it. And ordinary common dinoflagellates, like you'd find in any pond or all throughout the ocean,
which are
algae.
Algae. That create algal blooms, red tide,
exactly.
All that stuff, yep.
Exactly. So two very topical health issues, red tide and malaria, along with a swag of other diseases, could be of interest when studied using this bug.
Yeah.
Not so much cures, but basic understanding and basic science of how these two large phyla evolved. That is dinoflagellates, and the parasites go by the name of apicomplexans for reasons which I can go into, but you're probably better I wouldn't.
No, boring. Yes, well, a plasmodium that caused malaria, don't they move by themselves? Can't they move along like amoebae?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you find for a lot of parasites that give us trouble and all of our livestock. also riddled with these kind of parasites.
Yeah.
If you looked at them under a microscope, you wouldn't really know that they were not a dinoflagellate or an amoeba, as you say.
Mm.
So that all life on Earth, all highly complex life like plants, animals and fungi, have evolved from single-celled organisms. And in fact, if you look at one of our white blood cells, Helen, from you or I, it'll look like exactly like an amoeba.
Will it really? Yeah. Well.
Yeah, moving around, we are kind of collected.
You mean macrophages and.
That's it. Yes. So you've seen that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So, and you may have seen Plasmodium, the agent of malaria. So yeah, you're right.
I have.
It moves in and out of blood cells.
Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't look friendly. It's clearly looking to get inside another cell. And it's evolved from an organism which lived inside corals.
Mm.
And, well, we now have this organism, so we can say this. It lived inside corals.
Mm.
And while inside corals, it was able to soak up sunlight, feed reduced carbon to the coral as sugars, and obtain from the coral its waste materials in the form of urea or ammonia, which are nitrogen sources, and to some extent phosphorus sources from the host. So it was a handy partnership that developed, you'd have to say, anywhere between 300 and 500 million years ago.
And what's the coral made of? What organisms make the coral skeleton?
Coral is actually a very basal, or as we say, a root organism, a very ancient organism of the animal lineage.
Mm.
It's true that when you are out snorkeling and you see these things, you probably regard them as plants because they won't reach out and grab you. You feel like you're wandering around in a garden.
Yeah.
But at the microscopic level, these are filter-feeding animals. Think of an anemone or a jellyfish.
Oh.
They are using their tentacles to pull in food.
Mm.
Now, coral is absolutely no different whatsoever, except that it's made up of a bunch of tiny little anemones. Try saying that five times fast. It's made up of millions or hundreds of millions of tiny anemones all glued together, and which are all actually one individual. But it keeps budding, and as it buds to produce a new polyp, we call them, the old polyp stays there by its side, and you end up with this carpet of them. And then what they do is at the base of the polyp, they manufacture calcium carbonate to form their skeletons. That way they get to grow up towards the sunlight. Light is what they're after, light and filter feeding. So the symbiotic alga that adopted that niche was taking advantage of the coral's good lot in life, but it also had something to offer that the coral had long since lost. If the base of the animal kingdom ever had photosynthesis, you know, inherent inside it, it was lost hundreds of millions of years ago. And instead what happened, it developed this partnership.
Yeah, so the coral buds like yeast. Yeast buds.
That's how we raise
our bread and make pizzas and all of that stuff.
I like
stuff.
Your analogy, yes.
Yeah.
And imagine if all the yeast stayed together, what would you have? Instead of budding off and swimming away.
Yeah.
You'd have a mat and you'd just call it a fungus.
Yeah.
So coral is kind of like that.
Well,
you were saying to me yesterday on the phone, you really enjoy your biology, Helen.
Yes, I love it. Well, beer is made from yeast, budding yeast cells that... secondary thing, they produce alcohol, C2H5OH, which
That's
we
it.
Really like.
Some more than others.
Especially in Australia. Now, what I'm fascinated by is that the algae in the oceans use 50% of the CO2 in the world, and the rest of the CO2 is imbibed by plants.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't
plant.
That fascinating?
Yes, so this is evolution rearing its ugly head yet again. Why that is because the microbes started the whole thing.
Yeah.
They were the first, and then the land plants have evolved later, have come out of the ocean, as it were, and slowly occupied the land. Now, there's plenty of light on the land, so you can understand why the land plants are doing 50% of the job.
Right.
But the land plants have had to develop something new, which is an ability to use carbon dioxide gas directly.
Yeah.
What used to happen in the oceans before land plants came along was CO2 in the oceans is in the form of carbonate, which is an ionic form of carbon dioxide. It has one extra oxygen atom, and it's soluble, and it's always there, available to them. So that's how they're able to use the oxygen. The organisms in the ocean are able to use the CO2. It's in the form of carbonate. What happens then, this is the interesting part, is we now see CO2 as a bad guy because of global warming, and we're quite correct. But if you think of it in the other way around, carbon dioxide that gets consumed, whether in the ocean or on the land,
by plants,
will be turned into oxygen.
Oxygen that we breathe.
Yeah, so all
so
the time
it's a fertilizer.
It lets us breathe, literally. So all the time that we're worried about CO2 levels rising in the atmosphere, you don't hear so much talk about oxygen levels are actually going down. And that is the flip side of the coin. So if carbon dioxide were to spiral out of control, well, oxygen would also go down, and that affects organisms as well.
Oh, that's scary. Well, now, Bob, why don't you describe the process of photosynthesis, which is the fundamental basis upon which all life exists?
This is getting more and more like my job interview yesterday, isn't it? Well, it's a beautiful thing. It's best explained with pictures. But let me stare at this plant outside the window and try and get a picture for you. So light comes into the plant, and the same thing happens with a microalga in the ocean. Light comes into the plant and is received by molecules which can soak up light. Now, it's related to the phenomena that you and I call colour. When you see a colour, whether it's a flower or a leaf or any object at all, what's happening is the light that's going in, some of that light, which we call white light going in, is being absorbed, and only certain wavelengths are coming out. Now, let's go back to the plant. When the white light goes into the plant, so much of it's absorbed, and the only part left is the green part.
Oh, fancy.
Out of the light. Isn't that amazing? All those other parts of the light got absorbed, and were absorbed and what? So did they heat up the plant? Well, no. What did they do? What they did is they supplied that energy of that light directly to the plant. The plant uses that light energy to make sugars. It's the best way to phrase it. A better term would be carbohydrates.
With chlorophyll.
Yeah, chlorophyll is the name of those coloured dyes that receive the light and convert it into energy. Mm. So the chlorophyll has some helpers, some proteins and such, but essentially the chlorophyll is the first collector and then channels the energy into this other apparatus. How about that?
Yeah, but what? And then so how is the oxygen produced?
Oxygen, well, en route to turning that energy into sugar, you have to realise that energy is not made of atoms. Energy is made of photons. And so there's
from
a chain
the sun,
of events there.
From the sun, yeah.
From the sun. And photons are really just pure energy. They're nothing you can put a name on. They're not an electron or an atom. So the chain of events is, the photons come into the plant and they excite a molecule of chlorophyll. That chlorophyll then is able to take part in a reaction we call electron transport. And in this process, the electrons move from one side of a membrane onto the other side of a membrane. In doing so, they build up a little battery inside the cell, literally. So while the sun shines, this battery is on. And the battery consists of atoms of hydrogen, and we call those protons, built up on one side of the membrane. There's a pump which moves the atoms of hydrogen across the membrane to make the battery. The pump is driven by electrons, and the electrons are driven by those photons.
Yeah.
So all of that's actually necessary in order to make sugars or carbohydrates.
Yeah, but where does the oxygen come from?
Yes. Well, it was always going to be a long story. when the battery is formed, now a molecule, which we call the cell's currency or money, passes by that battery gradient and it picks up an electron. When it does that, it's now supercharged and it's able to, as we say, reduce or donate an electron to another compound. The compound that it essentially donates its electron to is carbon dioxide. Now, carbon dioxide is directly convertible to oxygen if you just supply electrons. You're pulling off the carbon and you're leaving the O2. So say it quickly, CO2, and oxygen is O2, right?
Mm.
I'm sure that your listeners know at least those two formulas. Out of all the molecules in the world, those are the two that they do know, CO2, O2, and H2O, which is water.
Yep.
So if you write it down, CO2 equals O2, you're going to have to put a cross through the equal sign. They're not equal. But what's the difference? The difference is one carbon unit. So all of the apparatus I've just described, where light is turned into reducing power or electron donation power, can be used to donate an electron to the carbon, the C in that equation. The C then becomes able to join with another C. Once two C's form together, you don't have CO2 anymore. You have the start of something which is a sugar. Sugar has many carbons in it. So is that an adequate description, even though it's
long? Yeah, but how does the oxygen that's released get out of the leaf?
Ah, I admire your persistence. So once you've joined two carbons together, you've now got nothing left except O2 and sugar.
Yeah.
And it's just released osmotically. It doesn't want
it
to be inside the cell.
It just filters through the leaf
surface. Back out through the membranes, out through the leaf.
Right. Now, the C2Cs, the two carbons, then are laid down in the leaf and then they transport through the phloem vessels, I think, and are converted into wood.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
most of the carbon that's trapped in the world, well, half of it is converted to wood, right?
In the form of wood, that's right. Or another word for it is cellulose.
Cellulose, which is
wood. Yeah, wood is made mostly of cellulose. It's made of two molecules, cellulose and lignin. So this is not the case for the algae in the oceans. They have their own different kind of cell wall materials and things that they do with the sugars that are made from photosynthesis.
Mm.
But in each case, it's laid down as what we call reduced carbon, which means carbons that are all together. The quality of reduced carbon generally is if you supply flame and an oxygen, it will burn.
Flame and oxygen. Okay, yeah. I'm interviewing Dr. Robert Moore, a microbiologist trained at the Australian National University in Canberra and the University of Sydney. He's clearly an Australian, so you have to understand our accents. The description you gave me of photosynthesis then, Bob, is absolutely different from the one I learnt in first year biology at university in medical school, but also at school, high school. So we've learnt a lot since then. Also, I want to announce you're listening to If You Love This Planet. Now, I want you to talk. What absolutely fascinated me in the material you sent me is that all the oil in the world, or 90% of the oil, comes from algae, and I always thought it came from trees. Tell us, Bob, what it's about.
Well, that's an understandable simplification that your mind did and that our minds all did. And really, the teacher that taught us this had the same simplification going on. We don't look at things in the ocean. It's a hidden world.
Yeah.
Until Jacques Cousteau, I think it was, came along.
The famous French marine biologist.
Yeah, and the US Army decided that, you know, the ocean was something they could work with as an attack and defence mode. Scuba diving got invented, until then, we really never went under the ocean. People just sampled a few drops from the shore. It's this hidden world. So we wouldn't have known that algae were made, that algae were growing in the ocean 200 million years ago. They were competing for light and carbon dioxide. And to do that successfully, you float at the top of the ocean. And that way you gain an advantage over your competitor algae.
Because you trap the sunlight.
You trap the sunlight, you get access to the atmospheric gases.
And you can reproduce faster.
Yeah. And you win. You win the evolution race. So that some of these algae use a tactic in order to float, which is build up oil inside the cells. Oil is always lighter than water. We've all noticed that, right?
What is the oil? Is it a fatty acid? What is it?
The different algae have different oils.
Well,
and different
tell us.
Different algae use different oils for different purpose. The one I'm talking about is an alga that contains hydrocarbons.
Yeah.
Which is actually very similar to what you get in a barrel of oil, fossil fuel.
Yeah.
Oil as opposed to your vegetable oil. The one that you just mentioned, fatty acids, is what you get in your vegetable oil. There are algae which produce fatty acids, but the one that I'm particularly interested in produces hydrocarbons.
And oil is lighter than water, so therefore it allowed the algae to float and become much more efficient at reproduction.
That's it. And when I said that they could outcompete other algae in this way, very interestingly, that wasn't the only reason that they evolved to have these hydrocarbons in them. Back at that time, what actually had happened is a global warming event, similar to what we're headed for now.
And that's 240 million years ago?
Yeah. I don't know the exact date.
No.
There was a very interesting program by a science journalist, which I wish I could remember the name of for your listeners. And it pointed all this out. And it was just brave enough to come out and say it was algae. Mm. You know, the chemists have known it all along.
Really?
Passing down the chain through university lecturers and through high school teachers and then into our ears when we were high school, it got oversimplified. And we all use the analogy of coal.
Mm.
Now, coal does come from trees.
Yeah.
We were all right about that. In fact, sometimes when you hold a lump of coal, you can almost see the tree in it.
Yes.
Yeah. So we oversimplified and we thought black and black, coal and oil. And in fact, if you go to a coal deposit, you can extract some gases and a little bit of oil. But in the oceans, what actually happened, it's now coming to light, was these floating algae would eventually die and they would slowly, slowly sink. Even though the oil is lighter than water, it can complex with little particles of calcium carbonate, silica, magnesium, and it starts to sink. As it sunk, normally it would be consumed by bacteria. Bacteria would love to get their hands on some reduced carbon and chew on it and get their energy that way. But to do that, they'll need oxygen. Now, at the time, there was this global warming event, and the oceans of the world had become stagnant. They weren't moving. Normally, you have this huge current in the modern world anyway, a single large ocean current. We could think of it as a conveyor belt. The proper name is the thermohaline current, where water at the equator rises because of the heat. It then has to travel back along the surface toward the poles. As it does so, some of the water evaporates and that water becomes a little more salty. So when it does arrive somewhere near the poles, it'll sink again. As it sinks, it's pulling down oxygen with it that it collected all along that journey along the surface and goes down into the bottom of the ocean and goes back to where it came from, all the way to the equator, but along the bottom of the ocean. We call that the thermohaline current, or a simpler name is the oceanic conveyor belt. At this point in history, those currents had largely stopped, at least in certain parts of the world. And those parts of the world are where we now find fossil fuel deposits. What was happening there was that bit of ocean had gone completely stagnant. And so the only things that could live were things like these algae in the very topmost layers of the ocean. And as they died and they fell down, there was actually nothing there to consume them. No animals, no bacteria. The whole ocean was like a monoculture.
And there was no oxygen in the ocean for
That's
the...
it.
Yeah.
There wasn't any oxygen there. So, yeah. You know, it's a terrible thing.
So
when
does the oceanic conveyor belt put oxygen into the sea continuously? Is that what happens?
That's what happens.
So without that conveyor belt, there's no oxygen.
That's it.
Oh, my God.
And that conveyor belt's driven by the temperature differences on the planet. At
right.
the moment, we have a very warm equator.
Yeah.
And we have very cool poles.
Right.
There's ice at the poles, and there's definitely no ice anywhere at the equator, anywhere around the planet. There are times on the Earth, and excuse me, shifting time zone again here, when that balance completely disappears.
Yeah.
Such as at one point, the entire Earth was covered with ice.
Yeah.
Now, what we're looking at when the oil was formed is not a severe event, but it's major in terms of its impact on life on Earth. And the event was the melting of the poles.
Mm.
So instead of the whole Earth being covered with ice, there was no ice.
I see. And so the current ceased.
The current ceased.
Okay.
And under those conditions, the oil, the fossil fuel that we have now in our car engines, was laid down by algae.
On the bottom of the ocean.
On the bottom of the ocean. Went from the top of the ocean to the bottom of the ocean, completely untouched. Then what happens is sediment covers it. The sediment grows and grows. You know, sediment in the ocean forms at centimetres or even feet per year. A lot of sediment was forming on top of them. And eventually, after it becomes hundreds of metres or even kilometres of sediment, it's very heavy, you can imagine. And now it's just part of the Earth, that oil. And that's what we use now. We mine, we look for that.
Well, and the pressure at very deep levels of the ocean is extremely high, but didn't it mm-hmm. get subsumed under the tectonic plates
yes.
as well,
yes.
Bob?
Well, I was leading up to that, but, you know, those, you're talking 100 kilometres then.
Yeah.
If you go a tectonic plate, like just happened in Japan yesterday, starts to slide under another tectonic plate.
Yeah.
You've heard on the news that the epicenter of that was 10 kilometres underwater. So that was the Japan Trench.
Yes.
They're some of the deepest spots on the planet. But that's just the depth of the ocean. The plate itself, the tectonic plate, was 100 kilometres thick, order of magnitude.
Yeah.
And the whole plate was actually sliding under. So the part they're reporting as the epicenter is just the very top part, you know.
Yeah.
So this new world now that we know nothing of, and we never will because you can't swim under there and invent scuba, is the Earth's mantle.
Yeah.
So only geologists know about that or need to know about that. When that starts to slide one under the other, you're talking depths of hundreds of kilometres.
Mm.
So any oil that's gone down that deep, you know, we don't have access to.
Mm.
So really it's sedimentary processes
that
have done the bulk of it. There is one large cavern somewhere in the Saudi Arabia or Middle Eastern area, which is the world's biggest oil deposit then known when I saw this documentary, which is a few years ago. And it has been folded under, but it's also been pushed up.
Yeah.
You're aware that when one tectonic plate goes under another, that one's gone deep, but the one that it went under gets pushed up a bit.
That's what forms mountains.
Yeah, that's how the Himalayas were made.
Yeah.
So if some of the oil was on the top layer as buried under sediment and then gets kind of squeezed off, if you will, by the plate that it's going under, it could get trapped under a mountain or under a hill. So you're right that some of the pressure happens there. It's not just the pressure of the oceans or the pressure of the sediment. And once this pressure comes on, the chemicals change a lot. And this is the real reason why our high school teacher and our university teacher weren't able to very confidently say it was algae that produced this oil. The oils have all been changed. But they do admit that the markers for fossil fuel that are in every fossil fuel deposit are molecules like, I'll give you some names, pristane and phytane. And if you look at these molecules, they are derivatives of the chlorophyll side chain of all things.
Goodness me.
Yeah.
Why did the algae deposits need tremendous pressure to create the oil?
They didn't. They were already oil.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah, the pressure changed them a little bit.
Just a little bit. Oh,
yeah, it,
fancy.
You know, it joins molecules together, basically.
Oh.
Yeah.
You're listening to If You Love This Planet, and my guest today is Dr. Robert Moore, a microbiologist trained at the Australian National University and the University of Sydney. Well, that is absolutely fascinating to me, and I'm sure to the audience that all our oil, or 90%, comes from algae in the process that Robert just described. And it's particularly topical and pertinent today because in the part of the world where these oil, the majority of the oil deposits occurred, and where we get our oil from, is under political turbulence, so to speak. And so the threat to the oil supply is very profound, and it could change the whole economy of the planet, right?
Yes.
Yes. It's and at the same time, actually today we're doing this interview, which won't be played for several weeks, but this is the day that the after the earthquake occurred in Japan, and there's a reactor there, nuclear power plant, that seems like it could possibly melt down. Now, the nuclear industry says that they're the answer to global warming, and when we run out of coal and oil, that's what we need. So at the moment, it's so interesting that the oil is threatened, the supply of oil, and maybe the nuclear industry is threatened. So what have we left? We have solar energy, which is what we've just been talking about, that actually created the oil. Yes. And wind. Okay, now I want to talk more, Bob, about biofuels. And I want you to compare. First of all, I want you to describe palm oil and getting biofuels from corn and the like, and then move on to how algae can be used just in this day and age to make biofuel and oil as it was once made 240 million years ago. So talk about what companies and corporations are doing now and how inappropriate that is and how appropriate your work will be.
Right. Well, there's a lot of question there. And I've made a few notes on this topic, so maybe you can help guide me through your question. What's happening now is people have realized that since the algae made the oil, I've just used the American pronunciation there. Your American listeners would be very glad to hear that. I have lived in USA for 2 years. In Australia, we say algae, and in America, you say algae. People have, since they've realized that algae made the oil, they would like to reproduce that. So it's become a real buzz. It's not unlike the dot-com buzz or bubble of years ago. And there's been quite a bit of investment in the first decade of this millennium. There's some of that still around, and there have been a few successes. So I don't want to point to any particular company or any particular scientist.
No, we don't want to know that. Yep.
Exactly. I want to discuss the general principle.
Yes.
So you've gone straight into the technical stuff here, and you'd like me to start with comparing what's happening with, say, palm oil and corn.
Yes.
To what could happen with algae.
Yes.
Well, I think the main difference is, while the public's worried about competition between food and oil.
Yes.
With corn in particular, but also palm oil.
Well, they're chopping down tropical forests containing high quantities of carbon, converting that to carbon dioxide and adding to global warming.
Well, they're also kicking out farmers, no doubt.
Yep.
When they plant palm oil plantations.
Yes.
And the corn that used to be distributed from Midwest of the USA to other countries, is now there's less of it to distribute because it's being used to make ethanol for people's cars. So in contrast to that situation, algae can be grown on just arid land by the sea that's not being used for anything else, and the resource that will be used is seawater. Now that's an oversimplification because you'll need some fertilizer, but certainly in terms of the land used, making biofuels from algae would not compete with food industries. Where it would compete is in terms of the fertilizer used. So I'd like to discuss the fertiliser a little bit.
Yes.
If I could.
Yes.
I think the algae also have the upper hand here, because what happens when you put fertiliser on corn or on palm is that a lot of it will just run into the soil and will run off with the rain and into the rivers and the oceans. You're actually wasting a lot of fertiliser when you do land farming.
And that also damages the rivers because you get too much nitrogen. The algae grow like fury. They use up all the oxygen and you get what's called eutrophication and the fish die.
Yeah, so the bad algae that are there.
Yeah.
If you don't mind me calling that, of course I love all the algae.
Yes.
But the uncontrolled algal species that are, you can't control which species are present in the rivers and the ocean, they'll bloom, and you're just wasting. The best way to look at it is just wasting a resource.
Yep.
Now, another thing that is very interesting to your listeners is nitrogen and phosphorus are what's in a typical fertilizer. These things have to be made, and it takes energy to make them. In the case of phosphorus, it's relatively easy. It comes out of the earth. It's not a limitless resource. But at the moment, there's still enough of it to last us 50 or 100 years.
It comes from bird droppings.
Used to mine whole islands in the Pacific to get this stuff.
Yeah.
But that's been used up, long since used up. And what we're left with is the natural mineral form of phosphorus.
Yes.
For instance, when glaciers form high up in the Himalayas and they grind the rock, you've got this very brown river, the Ganges, coming out. That's a rich fertilizer.
Oh, how interesting.
Because it's carrying phosphorus and other elements. Okay. So the key thing here, a lot of people are worried about the phosphorus, that we've already passed peak phosphorus, but I think the key thing is the nitrogen. In any kind of farming practice, and growing algae is going to be a farming practice. And yes, it has already started. Some friends of mine are doing it up in Western Australia in a big way. Couple of scientists with a big pilot plant. So there's an example right here in Australia where this is now a farming practice. All of these people have an issue, and I want to contrast how the algae people deal with it or what benefit they get from it with what benefit your corn farmer or your palm oil farmer would get. And the benefit they're looking for is the benefit from nitrogen. We've had a little bit of a chemical interview here, so we can keep going on that vein. The nitrogen that we consume in our food and that was necessary to produce the fossil fuels or the modern day fuels that we could create is in the form of urea or ammonia. These are forms of nitrogen. Most of the nitrogen in the world is in the atmosphere, and it exists as an inert
80%
gas.
Of the air is nitrogen. Yep.
Yeah, 80% of the air that you're breathing right now is nitrogen.
Yes.
And it's quite inert. It's not hurting you in any way, but it's not doing you any good either. It's just there. That's where all the nitrogen is, in the biosphere. So what's happened is billions of years ago, when bacteria evolved, they evolved an ability to fix nitrogen, as we say. And what we mean there is similar to reducing of carbon. And I explain in detail how carbon is reduced in the natural world. Nitrogen undergoes a similar cycle. So nitrogen is pulled from the atmosphere and it's grabbed by microbes who donate some electrons to it and turn into other compounds such as ammonium. This is the only kind of nitrogen you can feed a plant with or an alga with. Reduced nitrogen. Now, the way that it gets reduced in our modern world is a guy called Haber in Germany come up with the process where if you make sufficient heat, you can force the nitrogen molecules to come together in the presence of something else and form this new product, ammonium.
NH4 is ammonia.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. The reason that he developed it was for agriculture, and it's been a huge success. So, you know, we lead this lucrative and lush lifestyle now because of this guy.
Fancy that.
And it's a very energy-expensive process, and we rely on it absolutely. Now, I'm not opposed to such processes. Of course, I'm thankful just like the rest of us. But I'm very interested in what we do with that ammonium. It's generally converted to urea because urea is a more stable compound, and that's distributed to all the farmers in the world as fertilizer. Now, once you've got this fertilizer, if you realize the value of it, that a huge amount of energy, heat energy, went into it. So a huge amount of carbon dioxide was created in order to produce this nitrogen.
By burning coal to make electricity.
By burning coal. You would want to make the very best use you could of that fertilizer.
Mm.
It might have cost you $10 down at the local nursery, or it might have cost you $1,000 a tonne down at the local fertilizer supplier if you're a farmer. But in either case, it seems so deceptively cheap, given the amount of crop you can grow with it, that we don't realise how much CO2 was burned. And I can't give you the figure of tons of CO2. But why would we waste something that valuable? So with algae, what you have is, I can use the analogy of a hydroponics system. I suppose you're aware of those, Helen?
Hydroponic systems are where you grow tomatoes in water. But you just put the necessary nutrients in the water, like fertilizer, and and they've got the water, they've got the light for photosynthesis, and they create beautiful tomatoes.
That's it.
Tomatoes. So
tomato. I love tomato.
Yeah.
In a hydroponic system, you can actually use all of the fertilizer because you just keep using it until
circulating, yeah.
Mm, it's not running off with the rain.
Mm.
It's not an open system. Mm. But that's how algae are generally grown, because they're either grown in an enclosed reactor with a sheet of perspex to let light in, or they're grown in a pond. And either way, it's a contained system. Some of that nitrogen will be evaporating as nitrogen gas or as ammonium gas, but quite the majority of it stays in the system and gets used. Now, that's not the case when you're farming on land.
Mm.
It'll tend to run off.
So the point you're making is algae, growing algae for oil and fuel is much more efficient, and it's like a hydroponic system.
That's
now,
it.
And the other point you make, which is interesting, Bob Moore, is that you can use seawater, which is an endless supply, and you don't have to use fresh water to grow your algae, and fresh water is becoming more and more limited on the planet, right?
Mm, indeed.
Now, how far advanced is this algal industry, I suppose you would call, growing algae, which originally made the oil that we use in our cars, automobiles, etc., etc.? How advanced is it in creating man-made oil for the present time?
Mm. I'd like to answer that with what to me is the perfect example, where it has been advanced for a while. It's just that nobody's realised that this is an opportunity. This is a commercial opportunity.
You mean there's no money being put into it?
There wasn't any money being put into it. It's only this last decade.
What about the governments? What are they doing?
The government paid in the order of a couple of million.
That's in Australia?
Yeah, no, US government.
US?
In the 70s or 80s, to have some researchers look at the idea. And it was because the oil price had gone up.
Well, it seems to me, Dr. Robert Moore, who's a microbiologist, that you need to get in and start lobbying and teaching the people in the Congress, who are surprisingly scientifically illiterate, exactly what this opportunity is, and they should get stuck into it as fast as they possibly can. And it seems to me you should go and see the science advisor of the president, who is John Holdren, who I know, and teach him about it, and I can probably introduce you.
Okay, how do you spell his last name? I'd love to do that.
Holdren, H-O-L-D-R-E-N. He's a highly intelligent, he's actually a physicist, but highly intelligent. You'd better go and see Stephen Chu, who is the Secretary of Energy, who is a totally pro-nuclear man. So I can maybe help you get there. This
cool.
is a
That'd
matter of absolute urgency, and you need hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, I don't personally, and the industry doesn't. It should develop slowly enough that it's done well.
Yeah.
Like the reason I raised the example of what the US government funded back in the 70s and 80s is that it was a great thing. Everybody looks to that as the example for where to get some authoritative information. You know, I could go to China or Peru or somewhere and collect some algae, and the locals could tell me how they've been using it for these similar purposes. But I might not regard that as authoritative. I might want to do some typical Western reductionist science and get all my facts straight. So the great thing about that early infusion of money by the US government was we have a firm, if it's not even a scientific starting base, it's a matter of trust.
Yeah.
Somebody that's important
it's
actually
legitimate.
Showed interest in this
credible.
Already.
Yes.
It's credible. And it's had that air of credibility for three decades now. And it reached the point where when I met a key scientist here in Adelaide in 2006, he said, they get all the credible scientists together, not the government anymore. It's just self-sustaining. The scientists themselves will call a meeting and you'll get like, say 20, anywhere up to 50 people, a typical conference seminar full of people who are engineers coming together and the odd microbiologist. And they'll say, well, is this industry going to take off or is it not? If so, what's the time frame? What kind of amounts of money have to be raised? And the basic agreement that they need to have is whether or not the industry is going to happen. So are all the physical laws actually honoured? Do you get more energy out of this than you put in? And they came up with the answer that yes, it would be quite possible that in 30 years from that date, so it's now 25 years, algae could replace a large percentage of the diesel in the world.
So now, that's the time frame. Is it 25? Yeah. It's a long time.
Yeah. It's a long time. And that's because scientists are conservative.
I know.
They will dot all their I's, cross all their T's, and there'll be no risk taken. So in a riskless environment, it will be that many years. Of course, what happens in the capitalist world is those who take the risk get the prize. So it won't be that long. And furthermore, it won't only be diesel. The reason he cited diesel to me, this eminent scientist, was that your question has pointed to the answer to that. Before you said, what are these oils? Are they fatty acids, as in like vegetable oil? Or are they something more like fossil fuel? And I said, I'm interested in the fossil fuel one. This other guy was interested in the vegetable oil kind. He saw it as easier to make, easier to control, and there's a bigger market for it. It's less sexy. And I've heard another expert say that the organism that I'm trying to culture, which is the name of Botryococcus brawnii, for any scientifically minded listeners, it's a hydrocarbon producing alga. He says that's like the sexy woman you can't have, as opposed to the more ordinary woman that you can easily have.
That's a very sexist remark, and I resent it.
Yeah, and I resented it when he said it. And he was actually very pessimistic about the whole industry. So it was no wonder he was just titillating himself with these kind of thoughts. But we are really for real, me and my colleagues. And we're looking at both the organisms which produce vegetable oils and the organisms which produce hydrocarbons. And we're going to make a go of them. I wish I could give you a time frame, Helen, because you're so sincere in wanting to know it. I have to treat it as an academic topic.
Yes, of course you do.
Yeah, as a consultant, I work 100% at the moment for commercial companies who I can't name, but it doesn't matter. You know, they're not known names.
I don't want to know them.
Yeah.
I don't care.
But it shows you that the interest is there. You know, the funding is coming.
Well, I'll tell you another thing that you should organise to present a paper at the National Academy of Sciences in America, because they're extremely important and totally credible, as you know.
Yes.
And get some of your colleagues together maybe to organise a session at their annual meeting.
Well, the way it tends to work, as you'll remember from your science days when you did it full-time, Helen?
Yes.
Am I right? That the way it tends to work is someone makes the germ of a discovery.
Yes. It's published.
They release a little bit. Yeah. Like maybe they make a poster for one of these conferences.
Yeah. And
this is exactly what happened to me with my big discovery of a new algal phylum related to malaria.
Yeah.
A poster was presented at the Linnaean Society in London, and it got a little bit of interest. And I was pleased, but I went away empty-handed. You know, no one said, why don't you publish this in our journal? So far from presenting a paper, a major paper at a major conference by a world-leading organisation like the National Academy of Sciences of USA, you build up slowly. So, but it's because of the little things that you get to that end.
That big things happen.
Yeah. Mm. What happened in my case was I presented at the Linnaean Society in London. Some people noticed, and the discussion started among them, and then they started to wonder, when is this guy going to publish? Now, that wondering of theirs did me a great deal of good, because in the ensuing, let me think how many years, 4 years, we were collecting data, and we eventually got enough data to write a very nice paper, and we sent it off to the leading journals in the world. We sent it to the American leading journal, Science, which is published by a group not unlike the National Academy of Sciences.
Yes.
And we also sent it to another leading journal in Britain called Nature. So Nature said they would take that paper. They'll only say that if all of the reviewers, all that they send this paper to, anonymous peer reviewers, like the paper, think it worthy of publishing, and that it makes a major contribution to science. It's very difficult to get your peers to agree that you've made a contribution.
I know that.
Yeah. These people are your competitors.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot of politics involved, and all you can do is quietly and confidently collect your data. When you've got enough data, you write it up as very best you can, and then you send it off. When you say present a paper, I think you mean present a talk, and that's a little more easy.
Mm.
But, of course, when you present a talk, even this interview, if I was to speak of any current ideas that we have, that's now public. That's equivalent to publishing a paper.
Mm.
So you've got to kind of keep a few of your secrets back. And when you present a paper, as you said, to the National Academy of Sciences, what you'll tend to do is you'll speak about something you've already just submitted to a journal.
Mm.
And so my direct answer to your question is, you know, we're very close with work that we're doing on Botryococcus brawnii.
Excellent,
yeah, on Botryococcus brawnii to announcing a few things to the world. And you'll be the first to know, of course, Helen.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
Yeah.
I think we're nearly running out of time. You had a few sort of philosophical... I'm interviewing Dr. Robert Moore, who's a microbiologist and obviously Australian, on how oil was made. But you had some very interesting philosophical things to say at the end of your letter to me before we... Would you like to just sort of summarise what you said in that last paragraph in the last 5 minutes?
Yep, sure. So when you get involved in the evolution field, you get stuck in a tug of war that's going on in humanity. And you may even come to regret it. So I'd like to give an example. Charles Darwin, he was the most tortured man. He knew that he'd come upon something that was basically true. He'd come upon it in the Pacific, it's true, but he had also come upon it in his garden when he saw birds falling out of the nest. And he'd poke his head up, and, oh, there's plenty more birds there. And he'd come up with this idea that the same thing that caused lizards and birds to take particular forms in island chains in the Pacific was the same force acting in his garden that was killing off the weaker birds and favouring the stronger birds. Now, that was an interesting, oversimplified notion and highly publishable at the time, but it's led to a huge number of consequences in our world. So what you've had now, people like Adolf Hitler and many, many others, and people in Australia, all of the early years of the Australian Federation, we actually had this term, social Darwinism. People actually use evolution as an excuse for racism. And it's very intellectually ingrained in us. So, you know, in the last 10, 20 years, we might have forgotten that this was the major driving force in sociology in this world for 200 years, but it was. So to me, I see the echoes of that everywhere, and I'm quite intent on using evolution in quite the opposite way. So rather than, for instance, evolution opposing religion, why can't they work together? You know, what have they actually got in common? And when you look deeply, you find a surprising number of things. I shouldn't go into the details because it starts to look like we're going off the topic, but evolution as a science is really something that can infuse energy into the public rather than drain it out of them and be something that the public wants to oppose or that gives Charles Darwin nightmares. If you actually look at the facts as they are rather than as a scientist conceives them,
yeah,
you start to see that it's quite freeing. It's quite liberating.
How?
And it brings people together.
How?
Oh, well, the most prominent example I could think of is a special came on the TV New Year's Eve a month or two ago. And it was by an American scientist who'd, acting as a science journalist, interviewed other scientists and tried to draw together a picture to say that there was such a thing as intuition.
Well, science is all about intuition. That's how Einstein discovered E equals MC squared.
Yeah, there can't be anything more to bind together science and religion than this concept of intuition.
Oh.
And you can actually collect data on this. You can put an apparatus on somebody's finger that measures their heart rate, and you can determine that the heart is actually the sensor in an animal and that the brain evolved later. And what the heart does is it receives intuitive information. And you watch a program like this and you
Well, I'm not sure about that, Robert. As a physician, it's the release of adrenaline after certain thoughts occur in the brain that causes
there
the heart to pump faster and the sweat glands to be more active. That's how
there
you measure that.
I'm not saying it's not controversial. Here's an engineer who's decided long ago there are these divisions in society.
Mm.
Here's an engineer who's basically a good American Christian who'd like to see what we can measure. So in science, that's how we approach it.
Yeah, you measure.
We have an idea, but we go out and we measure things.
Yeah.
So I'm proud to be a scientist in that sense.
Robert, it's been a wonderful interview. I really thank you very much. It's been especially fascinating for me as a biologist and a physician, and I'm sure to many of your audience who need to understand science more deeply.
It can be fun.
Yes.
It's the best way to put it.
Yes. So thanks very much, Robert.
Okay. Helen, thanks so much.
My guest this week on If You Love This Planet has been Dr. Robert Moore, a freelance biotechnological consultant specializing in algae and the formation of oil. Thanks for listening today. If you want to look at more programs, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org, especially now since the accident in Japan at the nuclear reactor following the massive 8.9 earthquake. Tune in next week for another, I think, fascinating program. And thanks for listening today. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.